Deutsche Welle Spotlight on Europe.
Hello and welcome to our weekly program Spotlight on Europe, coming to you from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I am Zipporah Nyambura. Coming up, the rise of populism in Europe as two far-right parties emerge as the main forces in Italian politics. Is the plight of young people in the country to blame for the rising populism?
We don't have the money. I'm living with my parents. I have 32 years and I cannot go outside of my home.
I study and I also work, but I can't afford to live alone because I have a really low wage.
The world marks International Women's Day, but have things changed at the European Parliament since the Me Too campaign focusing on sexual harassment got underway? Those stories and more, stay tuned. We start off in Italy, where many are still coming to terms with the unclear result of the just-concluded elections. Two populist parties have emerged as main forces following the polls, the Five Star Movement and the League, which has stepped up to head the centre-right. Like many populist parties, they have been tapping into concerns about migration, jobs and globalization. My colleague Keith Walker spoke with Reuters chief Italy correspondent Crispian Balmer and started by asking him if this was a major turning point for Italy.
I think it definitely is. The mainstream, the traditional parties have really been swept to one side by these two groups that are untraditional, are to a degree anti-establishment, and have really tapped into public anger over the economy, over migration, over all the things that aren't working in Italy. And the mainstream parties, both on the centre-left and the centre-right, just didn't see this coming.
What swung it? Was it the economy? Was it migration? Was it both?
I think the vote was split into two. So the five-star has emerged very much as the largest party in Italy. It took almost a third of all votes. But down in the south, it was a total tsunami. They won so many candidates in Sicily, for example, that they didn't even put up as many people as positions they've won. So they've got to try and find new people to fill those posts. It was a total, huge, I think unprecedented victory across the south. And there it was the economy. The south is very underdeveloped. It's got a very high rate of unemployment. It's got an industrial base that has just shrunk back to almost nothing. Something like 500,000 young people have left the south since the financial crisis over the last decade. And people want help. They want a more present state, and that's what the Five Star was promising, particularly in the shape of what's called a universal wage, i.e. some sort of welfare benefit for the unemployed and the poor, which at present doesn't exist in Italy. Whereas up in the north, where the Northern League, the League, did particularly well, there the issue was more migration, immigration, and also the promise of a flat tax. They promised to introduce just one tax raise of 23%. Down in the south, that's pointless because hardly anybody pays any taxes. Up in the north, it's a big issue. So the demands of the kind of the two electorates were very diverse.
So this is a real wake-up call for the Italian authorities.
I think it's a wake-up call for Italy. I think it's also a wake-up call for the rest of Europe. I don't think it's healthy for the rest of Europe to have a southern, it's sort of big southern country to be so split. To get out of this problem, they need to throw money at it. The problem is Italy doesn't have any money.
What's happening in Italy is also happening elsewhere in Europe. For example, in Greece, we see left and right-wing radicals making up its ruling coalition. In Hungary, conservative populists rule. We have right-wing populists in Austria's government. Here in Germany, right-wing populists are now the biggest opposition party in parliament. In fact, the AfD is the most popular party in some parts of eastern Germany. And, of course, in the UK, a nationalist anti-EU sentiment has disrupted the country's established parties, which led to Brexit. I mean, how much more can the European Union handle?
I think the worst of the sort of the crisis, the sovereign debt crisis, and the populism that fueled is probably past. And with the election of Macron, with the creation of a grand coalition in Germany, they probably breathed a big sigh of relief. I do think that a kind of a blind adherence to budget rigor when it comes to Italy is just going to exacerbate the problem. And I think that also they're going to have to work out a pan-continental answer to the migration crisis. You know, this vote is to a degree to be blamed on other European capitals that refused to help Italy deal with this influx of migrants. They told Italy, no, we're not going to take any of them, with the exception of Germany. Other countries, France, Britain, Spain, just no way. Hungary, Poland. And as a result, you've got now the League and the Five Star, you know, the biggest parties in Italy. And they're going to be demanding change from Brussels. And I think, you know, Brussels is going to have to come up with solutions. Otherwise, it will be in big trouble.
And what is the solution?
Well, I'm not sure. One solution is to do much more with Africa to try to stop this flow of people. The population in Africa is rising, and I think Europe is going to have to do more to try and boost the economy in Africa to make sure people don't want to leave. Another solution is to start sharing out some of these people who are in Italy. 600,000 in Italy is a large number. 600,000 spread out between 28 countries is much more manageable. And I think that there has to be more solidarity there. If the European Union is to mean anything, there has to be more solidarity there. And I think they've got to work more closely, which they've been doing for the past year, but, you know, again, more closely with the Libyans to try and hold back maybe some of these migrants and to try and find a legal way for migrants to come to Europe.
Reuters chief Italy correspondent Crispian Balma talking to my colleague Keith Walker. Mama, I wanna thank you for all the efforts, for all the sweat, for all the comfort. You never ask for anything in return. Your love is so unconditional. You carry on your work. You are the firmament of Mother Earth. Really, words can explain. That's why I have to sing, Mama. No matter what part of the world we come from, we all know of young people who do not want to leave mama's nest even when they are of age. Here in Germany, it's called Hotel Mama. In Italy, it's Babboccioni. But some argue it's because there are no jobs for the young people. Two-thirds of young Italian adults up to the age of 34 are still living with their parents and cannot afford to set up on their own. The so-called Babboccioni were an issue in the election campaign and may well have helped sway the result. From Rome, Stephen Beard reports.
Babboccioni is an insult. It means big babies or overgrown spoiled kids. A politician first used the term here a few years ago to shut up pampered young people, many of them still living at home and complaining about their lot. But at this recent protest in Rome against job insecurity, I met Matteo Frigerio. He works in airport administration and insists that many young Italians are forced to live with mum and dad.
The rent of the apartment are too high and we don't have the money. I'm living with my parents. I have 32 years and I cannot go outside of my home.
You are a Babboccioni yourself.
In a certain way, yes.
65% of 18 to 34-year-old Italians still live in the family home. That's a bigger percentage of that cohort than anywhere else in Europe. Many of these home-dwelling young Italians, like 21-year-old student Martina Antonini, say they have little choice.
I live with my parents. I study and I also work, but I can't afford to live alone because I have a really low wage.
Martina is desperate to fly the nest, and so is her older sister, a graduate.
Even my sister, she's 27 years old and she lives with us, but she also can't afford to live alone. She's just a waitress now. She has a master's degree in psychology.
Italy's low-wage economy makes matters worse, and so does the scandalously high youth unemployment rate of 32%. This issue loomed large in the recent election campaign. Massimo Ungaro was a candidate for the centre-left Democratic Party.
We have a huge problem of youth unemployment, as you may know. We have 2.4 million of NEETs, people, young people who are not studying nor working. Italian youth are the real victims of the crisis and of this political system.
But since his party has been in power for around 5 years, it was blamed by many young people for the high level of youth unemployment. Young voters abandoned the Democrat Party in their droves. They didn't exactly flock to the other main centrist party either, the centre-right Forza Italia. Hardly surprising, that party seemed even less sympathetic to their plight. I've come here to the Baroque splendour of the Palazzo Madama, seat of the Italian Senate, to speak to a Forza Italia politician who's been rather critical of the Bamboccioni, Senator Lucio Malan.
In some cases, it is because it is much better to be fed and housed and cuddled by their mothers than going to work.
Politicians can try to tackle youth unemployment, he says, but...
we cannot do anything for the over-cuddled young men and women.
That may sound heartless, and that attitude may have put off many young voters too, but there is something in it, says Patrizio Nasirio of the Italian news agency ANSA. The phenomenon of the Bamboccioni does owe much to culture as well as economics.
A lot of people in Italy prefer to stay home because, you know, for some of them, independence is less desirable than mama cooking and ironing your clothes. I mean, that's a fact.
And mama is more than happy to oblige.
She's happy for kids not to leave the nest.
That's not the case, though, with at least one mama, the mother of 21-year-old student Domiziana Dominiconi.
She wants me to leave.
Oh, she does?
Yes. As soon as possible.
Domiziana aims to leave home as soon as she graduates, and to leave Italy too, to live and work in France.
Because I have a lot of friends that live in Paris. At my age, they work and they have a home of their own. It's easier there, I think.
200,000 young Italians emigrate every year, a shocking flight of human capital, say the critics, which puts the problem of the Bamboccioni in perspective and underlines the ultimate irony. In spite of its bambino-loving culture, Italy is driving its young people away.
Stephen Beard reporting from Rome. Germany, all talk has been about a food bank in the city of Essen, sparking a debate about refusing to give food to people without a German passport. The food banks are charity centers where people who cannot fend for themselves get free food. Thus, this move has been dubbed as discrimination against migrants and refugees. So, is it fair to shut foreigners out from receiving this kind of charity? Another food bank in Berlin actually thinks so. Reporter Love De Wright went there to find out more.
A bunch of vegetables for a soup, a leek. Some of the first things customers at this food bank are collecting. It's one of the 45 food banks in Berlin. This one runs once a week out of a tall red brick church in Reinickendorf, a poor northern district of the capital. A dozen or so cheerful volunteers in red aprons have been sorting donations all morning. Fruit and veg, meat and dairy, bread and a few sweet treats. They'll help to feed 130 households in the area, around 350 people. And that's its limit. This food bank is one of just four in Berlin which has had to stop accepting new customers completely, regardless of where they're from. So what do the volunteers here think about Essen Food Bank's decision?
I think the head of the Essen Food Bank worded his decision rather poorly.
That's Ingrid Winterhager, who's been helping to organise this food bank since it started more than 11 years ago. And here's the statement the Essen Food Bank put on its website.
Due to the increase in the number of refugees in recent years, the number of foreigners among our customers has now reached 75%. We therefore feel we have been forced, in order to ensure proper integration, only to accept new customers who have a German ID for the time being.
Jörg Sator, head of the Essen Food Bank, told a local newspaper that some of the foreigners had been pushing and shoving in the queue, with no consideration for the German grandmothers waiting to collect food. But does that justify his decision to exclude them?
I completely agree with the Berlin Food Bank's statement that people in need are not split into first and second class. The challenge, and I think this is a situation the Essen Food Bank is coming from, is that we have to keep being able to do what we do. A lot of the customers here are foreigners or refugee families, and that does come with its challenges for us, not only with the language, but also they're not used to our food, and they need a lot of support, which can mean other people might end up feeling a bit neglected.
Across Germany, around a quarter of food bank customers are asylum seekers. That makes them the second largest group receiving the donations, after the unemployed and before pensioners. That's according to a 2016 survey by the National Food Bank Organization. The Berlin Food Bank Group says that following the mass refugee arrivals 3 years ago, it took on around 4,000 new customers around the city. But since then, it says its numbers have stayed relatively constant. So why do food banks in Berlin seem to be coping better with the situation than those in Essen? Ingrid Winterhager again.
It works quite well here now. At first, it was a bit strange and unfamiliar, but people accept each other here now. We're also lucky to have the whole church, so people can sit in here, and we don't have to deal with the queues, which can get a bit rowdy. Then people are called up by number, and the numbers are called in a different order every month. So it's never the same people going first or last.
189, 190. Keiner? 191, 192, 193, 194.
Before getting their food, customers receive a label, colour-coded, so volunteers know how many mouths they've got to feed. And they pay €1.50 per adult in the household. Then it's off to collect food set up at different stations around the church. Palestinian Syrian refugee and former hotel manager Atala Taha shows me what's in his bag.
I get some mixed vegetable and some fruit and some many things.
Some chocolate, some butter, and some milk.
Yeah.
It's not enough for everything, but it's just extra.
It's not enough, but it's okay. It's better, more than nothing. It's for 2-3 days. It's good. This thing is, he can help myself also when I want to buy something. This is good for 2-3 days. Yeah, it's good. I can save a little for the other things.
I ask him for his take on the Essen Food Bank's decision.
I think the people in the Essen, when I read this in the news, some things, I am not happy from them. You know what for? Because we are here guests. The German people like to help.
But while Atala criticises the foreigners who have supposedly made some of Essen's less well-off pensioners feel uneasy, an elderly lady here says she's never experienced that.
No, I don't think so. It does bother me sometimes the way they behave here in the church when they don't have the children under control. But apart from that, I've got nothing against them. It's wrong to exclude them by not giving them anything to eat. It shouldn't be like that.
But there are people who support Essen Food Bank's move.
Finde ich gut.
Yeah.
I think it's good. Well, it's best for the Germans. And they should take priority in their own country. I wouldn't have equal rights in Australia or in the US, and they shouldn't have them here.
The Essen Food Bank's announcement, since it came to light, hasn't been popular. The organisation has faced huge criticism, accusations of racism and even a graffiti attack, with vandals spraying the word Nazis on its building and vans. The move has sparked a wider discussion about poverty in Germany, with some of the criticism shifting off the food bank and onto the government. Berlin Volunteer Ingrid Winterhager.
Und uns ehrenamtlich tätigen wird eine Verantwortung auferlegt.
Volunteers like us are being shouldered with a responsibility which the government doesn't take on. Our food bank here is in a really deprived area and there are 5 refugee accommodation centres here in our catchment area. That's really difficult to manage. We've got enough customers as it is. And then the refugee families on top of that. Everyone here is in need and we don't rank people. But we can't cope because we don't have enough food to give out.
Despite the difficulties, the atmosphere here is positive. It's hard not to make friends here, a young single mother tells me. The volunteers hope they'll be able to accept new customers again soon. But with poverty on the rise in Germany, the number of people looking for help from food banks like this one is only going to increase, wherever those customers come from. Loveday Wright for DW at the Reinickendorf Food Bank in Berlin.
Put it in, anyango put it in, me and he put it in, Nathini put it in, anyango soma soma.
On March 8th, the world marked International Women's Day, a day set aside to celebrate the social, economic, cultural, and political achievement of women. A day that also puts into focus the problems that women across the world face, sexual harassment. When sexual harassment became a global headline with the Harvey Weinstein revelations in the US, stories emerged about horrible abuse in the halls of the European Parliament too. From Brussels, Terry Schulz looks into whether the situation has gotten any better for women.
One of Terry Reintke's plans for marking International Women's Day was to hand over a petition to European Parliament President Antonio Tajani, signed by more than 119,000 people, calling for zero tolerance against harassment in the legislature, be it structural, sexual, physical, or psychological, the petition said. Although Tajani had strongly condemned the situation and declared his support for reform, he declined the German lawmaker's request to accept the petition on Women's Day, saying he wouldn't be in town. Reintke was disappointed, but not deterred. She's still hoping last October was a turning point, when in the face of numerous victims coming forward with tales of abuse, she and other parliamentarians stood up in a special session, holding signs with the now iconic hashtag, #MeToo.
Me too. I have been sexually harassed, just like millions of other women in the European Union. And I think it's about time that we very clearly say that we should not be ashamed, but that the perpetrators should be ashamed. Because sexual harassment is such a widespread problem all over the European Union. And we will need legislative steps in order to combat this problem.
Reintke was additionally harassed in social media just for making her statement, with men writing in to tell her she should feel lucky for having been groped by anyone. A parliamentary resolution was passed in October, but it's not legally binding. Among the petition's demands are mandatory sexual harassment training, all the way up to the MEP level. Currently, it's voluntarily, and few lawmakers show up. As well as a complaint review committee made up of non-EP experts, so victims don't feel intimidated to come forward. At the moment, anyone filing a complaint has to defend it in front of colleagues, sparking fears of repercussions.
Breaking the silence about this topic was a very important step to get something moving. And since then, we have been working hard, also behind the scenes, to try to really change something about the situation, not only in the European Parliament, but also in European legislation. And it's still on. So it's still a battle that we are fighting. It's not over yet, and we need to continue.
Now Reintke wants the European Commission to propose new legislation to that effect. Having more female decision makers may help avoid the situation where the balance of power is so skewed, where women almost always have less authoritative jobs. Measuring gender equality overall, the 28 EU member states together get a score of 66%. The Nordic countries come up around 80%, but other states around 40%. At the European Council, Christina Galak is trying to change that. As the gender equality advisor, Galak tracks whether the council is living up to legal requirements to engage women fully. Short answer, it's not. Galak points out university graduates are predominantly female, but EU hires are mostly men.
Women apply much less to jobs, to management jobs, than men. When they apply, the rate of success is higher. So what do we have to do to encourage women and help them feel prepared? They are already prepared. They just have to feel prepared to go for it.
She explains that while this is a big, big challenge, there's also been progress. In the past 2 years, about half of council appointments have been women. Activist Tanya Gohlert suffered sexual harassment for years at one job, despite her many complaints to superiors. Gohlert went on to become a driving force behind the 2017 Lights for Rights Women's March in Brussels, a sister event to the massive outpouring of antipathy that filled the streets of Washington, D.C. with demonstrators after President Donald Trump's inauguration. Working with the European Women's Lobby, she also spearheaded a discreet delivery of pink knitted pussy hats to NATO leaders meeting in Brussels last May. Gohlert says her conversations with fellow activists have made her realize something shocking.
I've been realizing this past year how every single woman I know has dealt with some sort of violence in her life, sexualized violence or intimidation. But this is status quo.
Gohlert says the world needs feminism more than ever, though it's often misunderstood.
People equate it with burning our bras. It's so much more deeper and nuanced than that. And we're talking about systemic violence here. How do we get people to realize this has really become a deep part of our culture, right? And how to change that?
Terry Reinke agrees that's the mission, as she's still hearing about sexual harassment in the European Parliament, despite the new spotlight on it.
Obviously, there is still people who think that this, you know, was merely a media hype and it's going to go away and then things will go back to normal. And I really want to make sure that this is not how this is going to end up, that we will really make a step forward, that we will have something that we can refer to, that we change the structures, and that there will be consequences for perpetrators and that there will be support mechanisms for victims of sexual harassment.
Goalposts for Women's Day 2019.
Terry Schulz reporting from Brussels.
Show me the way I can go. Take me by the end. Show me the way.
And that is all we have for you today. Thank you for listening. Do give us your response or feedback in an email via feedback.africa@dw.com. You can also find us on Facebook, DW Africa. Thanks to the rest of the team, Helen Sini and our technician, Get Gilgi. I'm Zipporah Nyambura from all of us here at Deutsche Welle. Have a wonderful week ahead.